Today is Monday, August 24th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump announces an emergency authorization of a coronavirus treatment scientists say may help recovery.
This is a powerful therapy that transfuses very, very strong antibodies from the blood of recovered patients.
Republicans and President Trump take center stage this week in their nominating convention to re-elect Trump for a second term. Also ahead, more than 1 million acres have burned in lightning-fueled wildfires across California.
It's a constantly fluid and dynamic situation that's happening. We have to make sure that our residents here are prepared and ready to go at a moment's notice.
It's all on today's International Edition. After hearing Democrats brand President Donald Trump a threat to U.S. democracy, Republicans will try to paint a different picture of challenger Joe Biden this week at a convention of their own. Last week's Democratic National Convention, held virtually because of the coronavirus pandemic, showcased scathing criticism of Trump's character and his handling of the pandemic. Joining us now is Kyle Condick, managing editor, Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia for Politics. Before we get to what to expect this week from the Republican National Convention, what is your take on last week's first ever virtual convention by the Democrats?
Just from a logistical standpoint, I thought they did a pretty good job. I mean, again, this is uncharted territory for, you know, for everyone. And I thought that there were some features of it that I personally just thought were very compelling and very good. I specifically thought the Tuesday night roll call to make Joe Biden the nominee, I just thought it was a great slice of Americana to essentially go all over the country and see people from every state and territories and getting some local flavor. I just thought it was a very nice presentation. It's also interesting in that the fact that you didn't have the convention going on in the standard convention hall, it allowed, I think, the Democrats to present a more united front just because, you know, I remember 4 years ago, Bernie Sanders delegates were kind of mad at the establishment forces, and that was very obvious. This time, now granted, I think Sanders and Biden get along better this time, and there's less animus. Also, I think that it allowed the Democrats to run a tighter program because the speeches didn't go on as long as they normally would. They didn't have to break for applause in the speeches. And so that I think also was helpful in just sort of making it more of a tight, concise program. I will say that I think one of the criticisms sometimes of the Democrats is that they're seen as sort of an elitist Hollywood party. Certainly, I think that was present in the Democratic convention, particularly on Thursday night. Julie Louis-Dreyfus was kind of doing like a little bit of a comedy routine that I personally thought fell flat. I think a lot of people liked it. It seemed kind of jarring at times where they would go from a very serious moment, Joe Biden talking about loss, and then they go to her and she's cracking a joke. It seemed a little discordant, but in the grand scheme of things, it's probably not that big of a deal.
Well, what about Joe Biden himself? Do you think he and the Democrats achieved what they wanted to achieve as far as getting the message out in how important they believed this election was and that they were the ones to make this change that they see is needed?
I think it remains to be seen how effective the convention was. I'm really curious to see if the race changes at all after the convention period is over. Usually around Labor Day here in the U.S., it's late this year, it's September 7th. That's a good time to sort of take stock as to where the election is. That said, I thought Biden's speech itself was very strong. I thought his delivery was very strong. I think he was, in some ways, he sounded like kind of an old school New Deal Democrat, sort of hearkening back to the days when Democrats, frankly, did a lot better in kind of white working class America than they do today. And I also thought the format really benefited Biden, that it was a very serious speech that probably wouldn't have been appropriate for it to be broken up by applause lines the way it would have been in a normal convention hall. And I thought that he had a great intensity and focus, and that I think, to me anyway, just as a viewer, kind of drew me in. And because there weren't any interruptions or applause or lines playing to the crowd, et cetera, I just thought it was a tight and focused speech, and I thought he delivered it very well. And I mean, there's a lot of criticism of Biden that he's lost a step mentally, that he shows his age, and I think he does in certain instances, but I don't think he did really at all in this speech. But also, I think there's been some comments commentary suggesting that Biden looked really good because expectations were low. Frankly, I think if expectations were high, he still did a good job because, again, I just thought it was an effective speech. It was right for the moment and it was right for the format. That's just my own opinion. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's going to move voters. I just don't know.
What can we expect, as far as you can tell,
from this week's
Republican convention? And did Biden do anything to make it more difficult for them to tear him down?
I will say that I think Biden certainly showed himself to be sharper than the Republicans claim that he is. And so I think that when you hear a lot of attacks on Biden, that he might have dementia, that he's lost a step, I mean, all these things that you hear about from Republicans implicitly or explicitly, I just think it's going to be harder to make that argument because millions of people are going to see that speech or see parts of that speech, and he doesn't come across as some sort of doddering old fool. You could disagree with what he was saying and think he'd be a bad president, whatever, that's fine, but he did not come across the way that he is sometimes portrayed. Now, there's another hurdle for the debates. Debates are going to be harder because it's not a prepared address, and so maybe some of these things creep back up into the narrative of the campaign and more people might believe them. That's one way I think that Biden was able to kind of pre-butt, for lack of a better term, some of the attacks that are going to be made against him by the Republicans.
What do you think we can expect?
You know, the president is going to basically say the Democrats are way too far left. They're the party of anarchy and protest. And I think it's going to be a lot of kind of hard-edged cultural messaging. You know, I think that the Democrats are kind of a soft-focused party in terms of their messaging. I think that the Republicans are going to be very hard. It's going to be kind of a hard-edged message next week. And it's sort of a matter of personal preference as to what you end up preferring. But I do think the tone is probably going to be a lot different.
Kyle Condick, managing editor, Sabato's Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Republican delegates to the party's national convention are flying into the state of North Carolina this week, where, because of the pandemic, there is a scaled-down in-person convention as well as virtual events. VOA's Carolyn Prasutti spoke with national delegates arriving from around the country who are eager to renominate President Donald Trump and win a second term.
Shirlene Ostrov is stepping out cautiously. It is her first visit outside her state since the pandemic. Ostrov is the Republican chair from Hawaii, a Democratic-controlled state with severe COVID restrictions.
Our economy is decimated. We have zero tourists coming in. Restaurants aren't open. And people say this is not the vision. This is not going to be sustainable.
It's also challenging to be Republican in the traditionally liberal state of Oregon, where Portland is in its third month of Black Lives Matter protests. Bill Currier says the president did his part to try to end them.
When he offered to help with national or federal resources in Portland to calm or quell the riots and so on, and the mayor and the governor basically snubbed him, that didn't sit well with people, even non-Republicans.
Democrats argued last week that Trump's actions as president worsened both the pandemic and racial protests. National polls indicate their presidential nominee, Joe Biden, now has a 9-point lead. But among Republicans, Trump remains popular. And among Americans, his 42% approval rating is a point higher than a year ago. Kansas delegate Mike Kuckelman says he listened to Democrats during their convention and didn't hear anything new.
I saw that, and a lot of what Biden said was just they were attacks on the president. He didn't tell us anything that he was going to do or his administration would do if he were elected.
Biden selected California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate. As the first Black woman and first Asian American woman on a major party ticket, she is seen partly as a way to win over women voters. Ostrov, who is raising two college-age daughters, says she doubts its effectiveness.
I'm not an identity politics person. Obviously, I'm a daughter of immigrants. I served the military. I'm a woman of color. None of that is important on why to vote for or identify with a candidate.
Democrats are also out near the convention trying to change minds, but not Tracy Honnels.
For me doing that? Absolutely not. No, I support President Trump. I've supported him since 2016, early on in 2016. I believe that he's the right person to take us forward. There's no way I would consider moving over to support Joe Biden.
Security around the convention hall is tight. The in-person events on Monday impose a limit of just 6 delegates per state and territory. And it doesn't end here. The 336 delegates are invited to the White House on Thursday to watch President Trump accept his party's nomination in person. Carolyn Frasutti, VOA News, Charlotte, North Carolina.
President Donald Trump announced on Sunday the emergency authorization of blood plasma rich in antibodies from patients who have recovered from COVID-19 for use in currently infected patients.
The FDA has issued an emergency use authorization, and that's such a powerful term, emergency use authorization for a treatment known as convalescent plasma.
The announcement comes after days of White House officials suggesting there were politically motivated delays by the Food and Drug Administration in approving a vaccine and therapeutics for the disease that has upended Trump's reelection chances. Scientists say the plasma treatment may provide benefits to those battling with the disease, but the evidence has been inconclusive as to how it works or how best to administer it. Massive wildfires continue to rage across parts of California. The fires, fueled by high temperatures, wind, and ongoing lightning strikes, including 100 that hit on Friday, well over a million acres have burned, and more than 200,000 people have been or are at risk of being evacuated. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Since mid-August, more than 500 fires have burned throughout the state, says Cal Fire's Bryce Bennett.
It's unprecedented. It's extraordinary. Mother Nature has dealt us a hand here that is pretty incredible, that we're adapting to and doing the very best we can to protect life and property.
He says the fires are a result of some of the 12,000 lightning strikes they've had and expect more.
This is a major concern for us because now we have over 13,000 firefighters out on the lines battling these fires in remote areas that should lightning occur, we have to pull back and retreat.
I'm Julie Walker.
Despite thousands of arrests, an aggressive response, and the president's threats to send in the army, tens of thousands of Belarusians took to the streets again over the weekend, continuing their calls for President Alexander Lukashenko to resign. Joining us now for the latest is reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. What can you tell us about what happened over the weekend on Sunday?
This was really the second huge set of protests we've seen in the last couple of weeks, upwards of 150,000 people. That's kind of the conservative count. And more importantly, this comes after President Alexander Lukashenko, the longtime Belarusian dictator, had threatened to crush the opposition, to crush protesters with his police force, with his interior ministry troops. So the fact that people came out and defied these threats, I think, is significant here. Mr. Lukashenko was in Minsk, where the largest protest took place. In fact, he monitored the protests from a helicopter that was broadcast on the state media, where he's seen calling the protesters rats. He later was also shown in another video exiting this helicopter wearing protective gear and carrying what appeared to be a weapon. Nothing's really changed in terms of the dynamics of what we've seen here. But at the same time, I think the fact that people came out despite these threats is really significant.
What they're calling for sounds different than what he is blaming this on. He has been outwardly blaming the UN and the United States for inspiring these protests and causing the unrest. But that doesn't, it sounds like this is more internal.
You know, I think you put your finger on this. There are these sort of two dynamics at play. And one of them is this internal struggle here in Belarus, where you have this presidential election, which occurred on August 9th. Mr. Lukashenko says he won it with 80% of the vote. The opposition says it's just the opposite, that Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who's the lead opponent there, basically got probably maybe 60-70%. This was a rigged election. Now, Mr. Lukashenko has been trying to draw this debate over the election in Belarus into this broader east-west struggle. So you have this idea of trying to sort of gain Russian support by saying that in fact Belarus is being attacked by NATO, by the U.S., by other NATO forces, by other NATO countries like Poland. And so this is an attempt to try and draw Russian in. Russia and Belarus are nominal allies, but the relationship between, say, President Vladimir Putin of Russia and Alexander Lukashenko, the president of Belarus, is not particularly warm. It's interesting that on Sunday, Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, made comments to the effect that it would be impossible to prove that Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko was not the winner of the election just because there were not international observers. But he more importantly criticized the Belarusian opposition of risking bloodshed by encouraging the public to go out and contest the election and protest. And this suggests that Russia, for now anyway, is continuing to sort of stick with Lukashenko, maybe out of a lack of alternative, and also also, I think, because they see some of the opposition members starting to meet with Western leaders. And I think this sort of sets off alarm bells within the Kremlin.
There have been some analysts who said that Russia could actually be interested in doing something similar like it did in Ukraine. Are you hearing anything about that over there?
It's a concern. I think for now, the sort of the general consensus here is that it's not in Russia's interests. I think people, particularly after the, as you say, the invasion of Ukraine, they annexed Crimea from Ukraine. They also invaded into the Russian troops were in eastern Ukraine, where there's still an ongoing civil war. But I think in terms of, from the Russian perspective, Crimea was a prize in eastern Ukraine ended up being kind of a mess, and they're still stuck there. And I think a lot of people look at Belarus in a similar way with eastern Ukraine. I don't think there's a lot for Russia to gain from this, and also for the fact that just the Belarusian, even the supporters of Lukashenko, aren't thrilled with the idea of Russians coming and taking over. But there does seem to be this effort to extract concessions from Mr. Lukashenko for Russian support. So, for example, Russia's been pushing for Belarus to pay more from Russian gas. There might be ways that Russia can extract concessions for continued support to Mr. Lukashenko, at least for now.
The protesters obviously are not deterred by the threats. What are they saying? Are they going to keep coming out until he resigns? What is their plan?
That's what they're saying, that they want Mr. Lukashenko gone at any cost, but they're hoping for a peaceful revolution. And the question is whether they can keep it in that framework. As you know, Mr. Lukashenko was not shy about unleashing the police and the security forces against protesters early on, several days after the vote. Many were arrested. 7,000 people were arrested and came out of the jails once they were released with bruises. We've had 5 protesters killed so far. So that the chance of bloodshed is very real. It seems that the protesters are very insistent that this is a peaceful revolution, that the leader of it, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who, by the way, was the wife of someone who actually planned to run. Her husband, Sergei, was planning to run as a candidate. He was arrested and jailed by Mr. Lukashenko, at which point his wife stepped up as a surrogate candidate. Now, she says she's no leader of Belarus. She says she just wants Mr. Lukashenko to go so she can call fair elections, which they would have then within 6 months. So that's the plan for now. But I think there is a real question of how do you, you know, if Mr. Lukashenko says he will not go. And so there is this impasse, but the people say they'll just keep coming out.
Reporter Charles Means in Moscow, thank you so much. Well, despite regional and international condemnation, last week's coup in Mali has been met with widespread street celebrations in Bamako, Mali's capital. The arrest and swift resignation of Malian President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita followed months of protests over alleged government corruption, a broken economy, and ongoing extremist violence. It remains an open question whether the military government's promise of a return to democratic rule and national stability will be realized. John Campbell, senior fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, speaks to VOA's Adam Phillips about whether he believes the U.S. can or will have any influence on what happens in Mali.
I don't think we have very much leverage over what's going on in Mali. We have a drone base in Niger. We provide certain logistical support for French forces that are operating in the Sahel. But so far as I know, we have no boots on the ground. I think we should be forthright in condemning what happened as a coup. But beyond that, I don't really, as a practical matter, see what the United States can do that will much influence the trajectory of events there.
The Western power that does have lots of leverage, of course, is France. It has 5,000 troops stationed in West Africa.
And I think we should all be watching very carefully the French reaction. The French government issued a statement denouncing the coup, but the French are ambiguous about this. Traditionally, the French view has been that the Sahel, including Mali, is the French equivalent of the near abroad. In other words, an area close to France and as such of primary concern to French security. Hence, 5,000 French troops in West Africa. The French public are concerned that the Sahel, including Mali, is becoming the Afghanistan of France. In other words, a conflict from which it's becoming impossible to extricate oneself. So I think the public view would tend to rein in any government interest in becoming more militarily involved, but not necessarily less militarily involved. So I would not anticipate, at least in the short term, any kind of French withdrawal from the Sahel. So What the French reaction is going to be beyond simple condemnation remains to be seen.
How do you think this French ambiguity and the international condemnation will actually play out?
It seems to me the most likely scenario is that the Malian military will announce that they are establishing an interim civilian government, ostensibly civilian, the military will control it, and that the job of this interim government will be to organize elections. And those steps will be broadly satisfactory to the international community, even though in terms of most Malians, it won't mean very much.
And to make the situation even more complicated, Mali has been plagued in recent years by an extremist insurgency. The deposed government's inability to bring them to heel was a major reason for the mass demonstrations that helped do it in. But there's now an even deeper political instability in the country as a result of the coup. That must be great news for the extremists.
I think that's exactly right. And what this does is it illustrates the secular government of Mali's inability to really function. And that makes the alternative that the Islamists are proposing more attractive.
What do you think is the real motivation of the military men who conducted the coup? I mean, they must have realized that this would mean more instability for Mali. Do you think some of those military leaders might actually have an interest in keeping the war with the extremists going for a while?
Some of them probably do, and some of them are probably making a fair amount of money out of it. But in terms of a broader motivation, I think there was a general fatigue with the instability, with the daily demonstrations, the threat of strikes that actually led to the arrest of the president. So too was the prime minister. So too was the minister of finance. So too was the head of the National Assembly. And the press says others have been arrested as well, but we don't know who they are.
John Campbell, Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips. Iraqi State TV reports that government security forces blocked main arteries Saturday in the southern port city of Basra after protesters torched the local parliament building and a number of Shiite militia headquarters in response to the killings of protest leaders. Protesters in the southern city of Nasiriya also attacked Shiite party offices after an explosion wounded 11 protesters overnight. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Protesters in the southern Iraqi city of Nasiriya used bulldozers to attack Shiite militia and party offices Saturday in apparent retaliation for an explosion in the city's central Habubi Square, which wounded 11 protesters overnight, according to Iraqi State TV. Iraqi State TV added that the local governor of the Kar province ordered police to investigate who was behind the explosion. Media reports say a bomb hidden in a motorbike was detonated near a crowd of protesters. Police in the southern port city of Basra closed several main arteries, calling on protesters to act responsibly. An angry crowd torched the local parliament building and set fire to Shiite militia offices to protest the killings of several prominent protest leaders. One protester accused pro-Iranian militias of killing demonstrators as the crowd around him torched the parliament building. Protesters are demanding that police investigate the killing this past week of protest leaders Riham Yaqub and Tahsin Usama. A Shiite member of parliament with ties to pro-Iranian parties, Kazem Siadi, justified the killings on Iraqi TV. He calls the killing of Riham Yaqub a political elimination, claiming that she was a traitor for going to a meeting at which U.S. diplomats were present. Paul Sullivan, a professor at the U.S. National Defense University, tells VOA that many Iraqis are fed up with Iran's influence in their country, including Iraqi Shiites. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. The United States Gulf Coast is bracing for a potentially devastating hit from two hurricanes as both strong storms swirl toward the U.S. from the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean. Officials fear a history-making onslaught of life-threatening winds and flooding along the coast, stretching from Texas to Alabama. U.S.-led international coalition troops withdrew from Iraq's Taji military base Sunday and handed it over to Iraqi security forces. The base, 20 kilometers north of Baghdad, had been the site of frequent rocket attacks by Iran-backed militias targeting U.S.-led troops in recent months. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues. African Americans are nearly four times more likely to die of COVID-19 than whites, by one estimate. But polls show that more blacks than whites say they will not get a coronavirus vaccine when one becomes available. A history of racism in medicine means trust in the health system is lower among African Americans. To help overcome those barriers, health officials are turning to a respected institution in the black community, barbershops. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
I get all my education from the barbershop news.
Fred Spry owns a barbershop just north of Washington. He's close with his clients, he says.
Most everybody has friends and family. And if they were my friends and family, they became my friends and family after knowing.
That intimate relationship between barber and client has deep roots in African American culture. Stephen Thomas heads the University of Maryland Center for Health Equity.
All this time throughout our history, black barbershops have been a place of refuge. They're like a sacred place.
What up, Fred?
Thomas says that trusted relationship is an important one during the COVID-19 pandemic because trust in doctors is low in the black community.
For many African Americans, it's part of the oral tradition that you don't trust people in white coats who come into your neighborhood to say they want to help you.
Thomas says that tradition is rooted in centuries of racism, including unethical medical experiments involving blacks.
That's the zone of privacy.
Thomas says though African Americans are dying of COVID-19 at much higher rates than whites, they're also more skeptical about a vaccine.
If it was available tomorrow, okay, would you take it?
No.
No? Everybody's waiting for a vaccine.
I mean, you want my honest answer or you want me to give it the political answer?
I want your honest answer.
But Thomas has a plan to build confidence.
No food, anything in the past 30 minutes, right?
No, sir.
For one thing, he wants black barbershops to offer COVID tests. For more than a decade, Thomas has been turning black barbers and stylists into health advocates. They've been helping educate their clients about conditions like HIV, heart disease, and cancer, which minorities suffer at higher rates than whites. Studies show it works. Fred Spry says when one of his clients got screened for cancer, his doctor found a tumor and removed it.
It felt good because it was like I may have saved his life and it may have saved his family from having to mourn over him, you know, much earlier than they had to.
There you go.
Thomas is arming his network of barbers and stylists with COVID facts to combat misinformation. And with the coming influenza season threatening to make a bad situation worse, Thomas wants barbers to talk to their clients about flu shots.
We need to be working on that right now. The reasons why people are not taking the flu shot may be the same reasons they won't take a COVID vaccine when the time comes. Fear, mistrust.
That could change, he says, with a shave and a haircut and a word from someone they trust. Steve Barragona, Kensington, Maryland.
And finally today, a famous British music venue where the Beatles made their name is facing a fight for its own survival. Owners of the Cavern Club in Liverpool, where the Beatles first played, like other venues, has had to close its doors since March due to the global pandemic. The owners say they'll run out of money if they can't reopen soon. The Beatles first played at the cramped cellar bar in 1961, and until the pandemic was still drawing thousands of visitors from around the world. As recently as 2018, Sir Paul McCartney returned to play a surprise gig. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening.